She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. My name is Beatrice and I'm here with
Elizabeth.
And as you maybe know, a few weeks ago, the quote-unquote alleged Golden State Killer got caught. Or rather, a very, very likely suspect who got linked to the case with 100% DNA match. So, quote-unquote alleged.
Sure. Let's say alleged because we don't want anybody to sue us. But
covering our bases. Yeah, yeah. And we wanted to take this event and the press coverage surrounding it as kind of a reason to talk about a subject that I know both Liz and I are very much into, and that is true crime.
Absolutely. So do you watch true crime? First of all, are there true crime shows in Austria? Like, do you have true crime television shows in Austria?
I don't even own a TV set, so I'm probably not the right person to answer the question. I do watch a lot of, well, actually, what I do is I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts.
Okay.
I don't know if there's like specific Austrian TV programs. I know that there is now an Austrian true crime podcast because I'm doing it, but I don't think anything like that really exists.
Do you have like crime shows that are based on true stories like Tatort or something like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. And also, I mean, on Austrian TV, there's also like CSI and all of that shit. But I don't know if there's like Austrian productions. I don't know any. I'm trying to think. No, I don't think I know any like Austrian true crime documentaries.
Okay.
There are TV series.
Oh, wait. I saw one.
Yeah.
It was a documentary, and it was about the guy in Austria, Fritzl, who had kept his family.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
His daughter and his grandchildren, incestuous grandchildren in the basement of his home.
Yeah,
I saw that on Netflix.
Oh, I think I saw that too, but I didn't know that it was an Austrian film.
I don't know if it was an Austrian production. It could have been a German production, but it was definitely originally, I think it was originally filmed in Germany.
Yeah.
I want to say.
Oh, that's possible. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I think the media that I consume are mostly like American true crime podcasts, I think.
Okay. So Serial.
Serial and My Favorite Murder and, oh God, there are so many. I like most of the podcasts that I listen to are true crime podcasts, to be honest.
We just went on a road trip this last weekend to visit my husband's family, and we listened to this podcast called Serial Killers that looks specifically at serial killers.
Yeah.
And they also do one on cults.
Yeah, yeah. There's also one by the same people that's called Female Serial Killers. It's also interesting.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just really, really love true crime podcasts. And so the thing that we wanted to talk about today, because you may already ask yourselves, why are they talking about true crime or the true crime genre on a feminist podcast? And the reason is we wanted to talk about the intersection of true crime and feminism, whether we can talk about it as a feminist genre, why we think it's necessary to kind of apply a feminist lens to true crime cases or to the true crime genre itself. And so I already talked about the podcast My Favorite Murder, and I feel like at the moment, at least in the English-speaking world, My Favorite Murder kind of is the most important thing that is happening in true crime.
I would say, especially the community that has kind of evolved out of My Favorite Murder, and I think that both of the hosts of My Favorite Murder are very quick to point out that, you know, this is a community that formed around them, but they're not responsible for this community. They didn't say like, hey, form a community. It like naturally and organically evolved.
And it's also, I think, something that we need to talk about this community, because it's mostly a community of women, which is also interesting. But I think before that, I just wanted, I think, to say that I feel like it's a very important thing in true crime, and it's also, actually in podcasting itself, My Favorite Murder is one of the biggest things. So the podcast as a medium itself is very much true crime based, or very dominated by the true crime genre.
Yeah, there are a lot of true crime podcasts, both in terms of, I mean, theirs is kind of considered a comedy podcast, even though it's not, it's dealing with kind of really serious things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are others that take themselves much more seriously, like serial killers. I'm reluctant to say Sword and Scale because, you know.
But let's not get into that today.
Yeah.
So, and I think what is interesting about My Favorite Murder is that they bring like this feminist perspective to the genre, and then also kind of a feminist sense of humor discussing true crime.
Yeah, no, it's almost a very kind of self-deprecating humor. It's like a very dark humor that acknowledges that women are most likely to be the victims of these, you know, domestic partner abuse or intimate partner violence, that they
are sexually motivated crime
or sexually motivated crimes. We are not, you know, the number one people killed by murder, but the types of murders committed against women are typically very horrific.
Yeah. And then also, and we already talked about this, My Favorite Murder is not just a podcast, but around it, people kind of created a whole community of murderinos is the name for it. And I kind of consider myself a murderino. I don't know how you feel about that, Liz, because I know you listen to My Favorite Murder.
Agreed. I'm so not all the way caught up because you know, I often listen to it on long car rides and when I'm at the gym. And But yes, I totally consider myself a murderino.
Yeah, me too. And then one aspect of that murderino Facebook group and the whole kind of movement that evolved surrounding this is that it also kind of has its own lingo. And then people use phrases that Georgia and Karen, the hosts of My Favorite Murder, also use in their podcast, such as fuck politeness. Which is something that a thing they said with regards to women being socialized into being polite and friendly and nice and helping everyone, and thus kind of putting themselves in danger, actually, and being very quote unquote good victims, you know, because they're taught to not trust their own guts. And fuck politeness basically says, trust your own gut, don't act according to the politeness that you've been socialized into, but according to what feels right and safe for you.
Fuck politeness is something that came on in their podcast very early in one of the first or second episodes, I feel like. And it really, I think for any feminist in any kind of place in their life, there's a place for politeness, absolutely. But when it comes to your body, your rights, that gut feeling that you have that something's just not right, there's no reason that you have to be polite to some random person. It's so funny because sometimes you're just kind of walking along the street and you choose not to smile at someone, or you choose not to, you know, acknowledge that somebody's there because you're going about your day, you're in a bad mood, whatever. And it's amazing the reaction that women often get from men if they don't smile at them or if they don't acknowledge catcalling. I mean, this isn't murder. This isn't crime. It's you know, if I don't acknowledge the fact that you think my ass is good, then suddenly I'm a bitch. And then this goes back to the whole conversation about toxic masculinity and incels and people who say that because I'm not acknowledging their appreciation of my body, of you know, me, that I'm the person who's wrong, not them for, you know, being rude and sexist.
And I think they particularly said that in connection to the whole Ted Bundy thing, because Ted Bundy went up to women asking them for help and you know, pretended to have like problems and needed help with something. And then there are women who got away from him. And then later on, they said, this felt so wrong. I knew in my gut that there was something very wrong going on, but I was polite. You know, I didn't dare to say no. And so I think it's a very like feminist thing to say, fuck politeness, trust your own gut.
It's something that we as women in the 21st century have gotten better at, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I came, my mother was definitely one of those people who wanted me to mind my manners and be very, you know, nice to people and not be, and be ladylike, quote unquote ladylike, whatever the fuck that means. It probably means not saying fuck. But, you know, over the course of your life, you just kind of come to a place and over the, over generations and as society evolves, you know, we realize that why do I have to be like this when other people around me don't, particularly people who have a penis. So I think it's a good lesson that you don't, you don't have to be exactly like the men in the room, but you don't have to be like what society has told you you have to be.
Yeah. And then another thing that is also on the merch, they also have merch with that slogan is toxic masculinity ruins the party again, which I particularly like.
Yes. And I mean, I think we all, toxic masculinity is like pornography. There's this great phrase, I think it's from a Supreme Court case about pornography when, or maybe it was before Congress in the United States, where they said, you know, I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
Like, I think we can point to a lot of things that are toxic masculinity, but not all masculinity is toxic. It's toxic. I think we all know that. Yeah. But when someone is exhibiting toxic masculinity, I know it when I see it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think I also like the phrase because it would also be so fitting for our podcast. I think we could kind of conclude every second podcast we do with toxic masculinity, ruin the party again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So now what is really interesting about My Favorite Murder is that it's mostly women who are fans of the podcast. It's mostly women who are murderinos. When you look at the Facebook group surrounding it, it's like mostly women. There are very, very, I think I've never ever even seen a guy on there. So it kind of makes the true crime genre a very feminine one at the moment and maybe also a very feminist one. And that also made me think about my own interest in true crime because, as I already said, I have my own true crime podcast because I'm like obsessed with the genre and obsessed with true crime. And I do it together with my sister Georgina. It's called Geschwister Grimm Podcast. And it focuses on Austrian true crime and it's in German, by the way. So I will add a trailer at the end of this if you're interested. So I'm obsessed with true crime myself and I kind of wondered why. So I sat down and thought about it. And I think I have an interest in looking at kind of the worst things human beings can do. Also in the sense of I want to be prepared for it, you know. So I think I'm a very anxious person. And the fact that I listen to stories that are very gruesome and I do research about them, the worst things that human beings do to each other kind of, I feel like, gives me a sense of being prepared for that. And then I feel like as women, we are all kind of socialized with this awareness that we are potential victims of male violence, like continuously. You know, we are the ones who don't, who feel unsafe when we walk the streets at night. We are the ones who hold our keys in our hands in a way that could, that we can fight off potential
or that we think makes it so that we can fight them off. It may not actually work.
It may not work at all.
We watched a television show one time that told us that that was going to do it, and that's what we do.
But you know, I feel like it's something that also being a woman in this world also means, at least this is something we learn, it kind of implies being afraid, you know. So and it shapes the world we live in, it shapes how we view the world, it shapes how we live in the world, how we move in public, how we live, how we inhabit our bodies, you know. As I said, walking home at night is different for a man than it is for a woman, for example. And, you know, researching true crime, doing like a true crime show myself, I feel like it's kind of taking back the narrative.
Yeah, I agreed. It's funny, even within fiction, there's a Harris poll that they did about fiction readers, and female fiction readers read mystery, thriller, and crime books at a much higher rate than male readers, 57% to 39%. It's, you know, it's the most popular genre between the two, but women read it far more than men do, which I think is interesting in and of itself. But yeah, I mean, some of it comes down to the fact that it is, you know, life as a woman is inherently more dangerous. When I go for a run, I only put one headphone in or don't wear headphones at all because I'm afraid that someone was going to jump out of the bushes. I have to pick the time of day when I run, even if I'm running on sidewalks and not in streets, because I want to make sure that I can see if someone's kind of coming toward me. things yeah. like that, where we have to be just more aware of our surroundings.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we can also get later, we can also get into whether that fear is justified or whether it's also something that is kind of fed by true crime narratives.
Sure.
But I think what I was trying to say is that being a woman, we learn being a woman means being afraid.
Yeah.
And there's something empowering in taking back this narrative. And there's also something empowering in kind of learning about dangers, you know? And then for me, that's also particularly, and it's just a personal thing, I'm very interested in like the personality and psychology side of it. So I really am really into like reading and learning about narcissism and psychopathy and all of that. Mm-hmm. Because the risk of being murdered by a husband that's psychopathic or something is like much higher for a woman than it is for an intimate partner, is much higher for a woman than it is for a man. So for me, it kind of, you know, do you know what I mean?
No, I totally know what you mean. But the likelihood that someone is actually going to be a psychopath is pretty low.
I know, but I still find those topics fascinating. And when you look at the statistics,
they're very fascinating. Yeah. But like, you know, we worry about these things. Like, what if this person like snaps and they, you know, they come into their psychopathy? Like, all of a sudden, the likelihood of an adult male coming into psychopathy in their like 30s, I think is low. I could be totally wrong about this. And if I am,
No. I don't mean like psychopathy is something I think that exists for all of your life, but I want to detect the signs. You know what I mean? That's what I'm talking about. So when I get to know someone, I'm immediately like, this sounds like a personality disorder. I'm not going to get close to that person.
Except that the likelihood that they actually, I mean, like a very small percentage of the population actually are psychopaths.
I know. I'm not saying that it's many people.
I understand. I think you're right. I mean, there's a concern that maybe thinking about this stuff all the time makes us hyper aware of it. And therefore makes us think that there are disproportionately larger numbers of psychopaths and people who are going to be a danger to us than there are. But I also agree that being cautious and, you know, being aware and mindful of how you feel about your interactions with people is super important.
Probably psychopathy is kind of the most extreme example, yes. But there are so many people who have experiences with like domestic violence and, you know, coercive control and all of that within intimate relationships. And maybe that person doing that is not like a full-fledged psychopath.
Sure.
They might have psychopathic tendencies. And I think that is something that happens a lot and much more often for men than for women also, which also has to do with masculinity.
Absolutely. And the narcissism piece of that is also the narcissism and gaslighting. Oh, sweet Jesus.
Yeah.
Making exactly. you think so, that like the thoughts that you are having and the experiences that you are having or you aren't actually having, like, oh yeah. my gosh, that like that kind of emotional and psychological abuse. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think that's what I was trying to say. So I don't think that many people are actual psychopaths, but I think that our version of masculinity that is kind of hegemonic in our society makes room for a lot of like narcissistic and psychopathic tendencies that men can kind of play out in relationships to women. And I think it's very sensible to be aware of that and to know what's going on.
Sure. No, I totally agree. And, you know, there have been articles written about how My Favorite Murder and other groups of people who, you know, either murderinos or other groups of true crime fans, when they get together and start talking about it, it becomes kind of like a support group in a way,
yeah,
where people can talk completely. About their own mental health issues, but also the issues that they're having with other people.
Yeah. So 2010, a paper was published in an academic journal called Social Psychology and Personality Science, and it's called Captured by True Crime: Why Women Are Drawn to Tales of Rape, Murder, and Serial Killers, by Amanda Vickery and R. Chris Fraley. And they found out that many more women than men are fans of true crime. And in the paper, they discussed why that is the case. So in the paper itself, they focus on true crime books. But then I found out in my research that what they find is more or less also true for other kind of true crime media. So when you look at the fewer numbers of crime fiction shows like Law and Order or CSI, Bones, a majority of those are women. And even if in the case of My Favorite Murder and podcast, I don't know any statistics, I don't know if they're available, but George and Karen, the two hosts, say that about 90% of the people that come to the live shows are women. Yeah. So it's a very, like, women-dominated genre. The paper or the study found out that women are more likely than men to choose true crime books over other violent content. Mm-hmm. And they are more likely than, so for example, books about war and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then they're also more likely than men to choose media that contains survival tactics and kind of motives, psychology, profiling, and more likely to choose true crime with female victims than with male victims.
And that makes sense because you can identify yeah. with the victims. So you can, yeah. you can see yourself in that situation. And it gives you a sense of how I can, you know, how I can not become this victim.
Yeah. And they also found, or they concluded from that, is that women have more to gain from these stories because they learn from them. Mm-hmm. And there are kind of two things that women learn from them, according to the study. First of all, it's kind of a preparation. So they learn actual tricks to escape. Mm-hmm. Because, as I said, they found that women particularly like stories that have kind of survival tactics in them.
Yeah, honestly, then, the show I Survived, amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what is also, what I also love about the show I Survived is that it's very often about like female persistence and like it's just also something that focuses on victims and survivors as an empowering thing, you know, not just as, oh, she got killed and now she's dead, but as in she kind of got out of there and she's such a badass.
Yes.
Yeah. And then the second thing that women learn from true crime, the study says, is that they learn to read warning signs, which is basically what I said, you know. So they said that many true crime media focus on like stuff like profiling or the psychology of perpetrators, and women might learn to detect the signs that, for example, a jealous ex-lover or stranger or boyfriend might turn violent. And they say, quote, the primary motivation women had for reading true crime novels was so that they could watch for signs of a potentially murderous situation. Reading this material allowed them to learn how to look for signals of potential violence in a jealous boyfriend or spouse. They also read the novels so that they could learn ways to escape in case they ever found themselves bound or gagged in the back of some van. Women are far more likely to be victims of sexual violence than men. In fact, one out of every six women in the US has been a victim of an attempted or completed rape. Women also account for 70% of the victims of serial killers who murdered between 1985 and 2010, and that is primarily because there is a sexual motive behind most mass killers. And then I found a quote from a blog that is called Uterish. And the author kind of came to the same conclusion. They wrote, true crime is a study of gendered violence. Statistics report that 90.8% of serial killers are men. Other recent data suggests that men make up 80.4% of those arrested for violent crime in the United States. Though murder victim rates are much more evenly distributed, women still remain primary targets for gendered violence. For example, it is reported that nearly one in five women experience sexual assault while on a college campus. Toxic masculinity threatens everyone regardless of gender. However, it targets women and trans and non-binary people in particular. Thus, feminist interest in true crime is tied to survival. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's amazing the number of crime, both true crime and fictional crime based on true crime stories, shows mm-hmm. that are available in the United States. Mm-hmm. And how many television channels are dedicated purely to focusing on those types of shows.
Yeah.
If you wanted to watch true crime and you have Netflix and cable TV in the United States, you can watch nothing but true crime all day, every day.
Which is what I do.
Yeah, sure.
Except that I listen to it. I don't watch it.
Sure. and honestly, yeah. staying at home and watching true crime, that's one way to avoid violence committed against you, but you do eventually have to leave your home.
Unless you're watching it with your boyfriend, who is the most dangerous person in your life.
And so. That, well, okay, that's fair. That's has the potential to be the most dangerous person in your life.
That's true. Potentially, yeah, that's true. So, and then they also concluded that the reason why women most enjoy quote unquote media with female victims the most is that it's kind of more relevant for them and they kind of identify with it more. So they write, the finding that women consider true crime books more appealing when the victims are female supports the notion that women may be attracted to these books because of the potential life-saving knowledge gained from reading them. If a woman rather than a man is killed, the motives and tactics are simply more relevant to women reading the story. And what I also find interesting, and that they don't really explicitly talk about this, they don't really explain it in the study, but the fact that women are much more likely to read true crime stories that focus on like serial killings and rapes rather than kind of gang violence and war. And I think that's really interesting because these are precisely the types of crimes that women are victimized by.
So I have a question. I guess the question would be, do they break down these statistics by race?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I haven't seen them broken down by race.
I haven't seen them either. I mean, they might mention something here or there, but it's definitely not a huge part in the study because I would have noticed that.
Yeah, sure. I think that's maybe a weakness. A weakness of some of the statistics that we see is that I think for the most part we're talking about cisgendered white women who are maybe reading. Yeah. I mean, and maybe not just cisgendered, but middle class, upper middle class white women.
I don't know what women they chose.
Mm-hmm. I'm just questioning the methodology as a researcher, as an academic. I'm questioning the methodology.
Of course, yeah.
I totally believe that women read these books and feel that they're preparing themselves. And I think that this is all actually very important. And I read these books for a lot of the same reasons. I also think the stories are very fascinating. But yeah. I also think that in terms of who are we talking about?
Yeah.
Who is this relevant for? Because I don't know if African American women are reading these true crime novels or true crime stories for the same reasons. I don't know if they're reading things that are more relevant to their lives. I mean, yes, African American women get killed, are murdered more than white women. But I don't know if they're
and trans women
are attacked. Violence is committed against trans women. At an alarming rate, but I question whether these studies are taking into account race.
I don't think this study does. Okay. I don't remember, and I just looked at it again, and it does no mention of race whatsoever.
Yeah,
in this. And I think that's kind of a criticism.
Well, I'm just saying, I it's not to say that the study isn't interesting, and it's not to say that African-American women aren't reading these books as well. It's just a question in my mind that if they're not, why not? If this is white feminist, I want to call it torture porn, but that's not really the right word for it. I was watching an episode of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Have you ever seen this show? It's on Netflix.
Yes. I know it, yeah.
And her roommate was having them watch basically the equivalent of Lifetime, which is this channel in the United States that is known for making, I don't want to call them schmaltzy, but kind of schmaltzy, like TV movies about women who kind of have abusive husbands or who are attacked or who are raped and how they overcome and how this, you know, all of that. And he basically called it like white women's porn. And that this is what they watch to make themselves like feel good about their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And said this to Kimmy, like she was watching this show and she said, why is it recommending all of these things for me? And she said, because it knows you're a white woman. And so this is what you want to watch.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if porn is really the right word to use because it's so much more than that.
No, it's not. It's definitely not the right word, because it's not that we fantasize necessarily about being raped and murdered, but it kind of allays our fears that our lives aren't so bad sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, the reason, first of all, the reason why I chose this study is that it's basically the only one that I found that talks about true crime as kind of a gender-specific kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. I'm not criticizing your use of the study. I'm just wondering aloud and...
Yeah, of course.
Wanting to have a conversation about, you know, is this something that is very divided along racial lines? Mm. And I don't know.
And I don't know either.
But I think it's a question that needs to be asked.
Yeah. I don't know either. As I said, it's the only thing that I found, and it doesn't even talk about race.
Yeah.
I think for the longest time, the true crime genre also focused very much on kind of, how should I put this, the, you know, white, blonde, blue-eyed victim, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And I think this is also something that's changing, also because of podcasts like My Favorite Murder, where they also talk about this phenomenon of the lesser dead, you know, of like people's murders, for example, that are not really even investigated because they're just considered, I don't know how to put this, but like, yeah, lesser dead, you know, like.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I'm not going to say that it's not a contemporary issue because it is.
Yeah.
But I think especially in the 60s and 70s, when you had people, you know, who felt ostracized by their families, felt like they didn't fit into their families. They ended up being quote unquote runaways. They might have gotten into sex work. These were people that as a society were judged for their life choices. And so it obviously their life choices led to them being murdered. And you know, it's not, and this is me being sarcastic. This is not me saying, yes, obviously they weren't meant to be murdered. Nobody deserves to be murdered. But as a society and police departments, they just didn't pay attention to them. So we have people who went missing in Native communities, in African-American communities. In the LGBTQ communities that just went missing, and everybody just kind of was like, well, he was a gay sex worker, so...
And it's this is a huge problem in Native American communities, or in Canada and in the USA. And it's just something that people have been starting to pay attention to very recently in the true crime genre.
In the Native communities, they've been focused on it for
years. I mean, like in the wider in wider society. I mean, in like the mainstream media. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the mainstream media.
In the DC area where I'm living right now, there have been African-American girls and women disappearing for years. Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. It's so horrible.
We have no idea. We have no idea where they've gone. We have no idea if they've been sold into, you know, if they've been murdered, if they've been taken from their families and are being used as sex slaves. You know, we have no idea.
Yeah. And I think it's particularly when it comes to children that are missing, it's usually white girls that we focus on.
Oh, sure. You can have 10.
Not we, but the mass media. Yeah,
I totally agree. Let's see. I think it's 43% of, I'm pretty sure it's 43% of all children who go missing in the United States are African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that the other 50-whatever% are white girls.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of children, women, girls who go missing in the United States are African American, which is horrifying. And we don't see anything about that. And, you know, there was this, there was an article that I was reading that was talking about how there had been a news report that they were talking about 10 African-American girls who went missing, and they interrupted that broadcast to talk about one white girl who had disappeared. Now,
oh Jesus,
it's not good for anybody, any child, any person to have just been disappeared, be taken, to be abducted. But
it's horrifying.
No life is more, you know, you can't just say like, you 10 black girls, like whatever.
Even the fact that they talk about like 10 black girls as like a group of like,
you don't even know their names. You know, everybody in the United States knows who the hell JonBenet Ramsey is, but we have no idea who these, you know, indigenous women are who have disappeared since the 70s. We have no idea who the black women are who have disappeared all across the United States.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, in that way, I feel like, you know, one of the things that I, especially in regard to sex workers, that My Favorite Murder has done a really good job of is raising awareness of that, you know, framing the discourse, making sure that we're talking about them as sex workers. They're not prostitutes. They're not whatever, you know, they're sex workers. Yeah. And that, yes, their job puts them in a position where they are vulnerable, but that doesn't mean that they are deserving of what happens to a lot of sex workers.
And it doesn't mean that that those crimes shouldn't be investigated because it's just considered collateral damage.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but I think this new wave of true crime is a bit different when it comes to that. I think recently we've seen more shows and when I say true crime, I mostly talk about podcasts because that's mostly the media that I consume. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a new kind of wave of media that are a bit more sensitive to those issues and that also focus on, for example, those that new Finding Cleo or Missing and Murdered Alberta Williams podcast. And then I think the second season is called Missing and Murdered Cleo or Finding Cleo or something like that, which also focuses on like, yeah, the whole native aspect. So I think I think it's starting to change. This is what I'm trying to say. And I think My Favorite Murder was a part of an important part in that change.
Oh, agreed. I totally agree with you.
Because I think before that we had like very sensationalist kind of Nancy Grace like things going
on. Nancy Grace is responsible for a woman killing herself. Nobody should listen to Nancy Grace when it comes to like Nancy Grace is a horrible person.
Why is she responsible for a woman killing herself?
Because she badgered this woman. I don't even remember what the case was, but she badgered and badgered and badgered this woman, and the woman, you know, I think it was her daughter maybe who had gone missing, and where there had been a rash maybe of, I'm going to totally get all of this wrong.
Yeah.
But whatever happened, she badgered the woman. The woman was made to feel terrible and she ended up killing herself.
Oh, fuck. Okay. Yeah. Oh God. Nancy Grace. Yeah. Don't.
I mean, just don't guilt people into like killing themselves, like to taking their own lives.
Yeah.
Empathy people. Empathy. Mm.
Yeah. So, to get back to this study.
Yes, sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I think it's a very important point to make. And it's also a point that I didn't think about when I read the study, which also goes to show that I don't always have kind of my intersectional lens ready because I'm a white feminist too. So one thing that true crime, and we already touched upon this, is true crime talks about also negative effects of patriarchy and hegemonic masculinity and also traditional femininity. So it addresses important issues that larger society pays very little attention to. It emphasizes imbalances of power in the home. It explains how that could lead to potentially violent situations. And it also takes on the idea of self-doubt in terms of mothering and child-rearing at some points, because what it does is it also shows women in roles that are not stereotypically feminine. So while women are often portrayed as kind of caregivers and mothers and nurturers, in a true crime genre, they're also killers and murderers and perpetrators of violence. And in a weird way, that could also be a potential for identifying with those women, not with the things that they do, but with the fact that they break with traditional ideas of femininity.
Let's just say we're not advocating that anybody murder their children.
Thank you for saying that.
But if you see, if you see a true crime show that talks about someone who suffered from postpartum depression to the point that postnatal depression to the point that she did harm her children, you know, if you have postnatal depression and have thoughts about harming your children, that might lead you to go actually talk to somebody about it and say, hey, there's something going on. And, you know, I love my family. I love my children, but I'm having these thoughts and maybe it takes a little bit of the stigma of getting help for postnatal depression away.
Yeah. And then also when you think about the fact that, and it's definitely I'm sure this is also the case in America, but it's also the case in Europe, is that we look at family and the home, as kind of a safe space where kind of women are the caregivers and they make the home homely and all of that. And then true crime kind of shows that your home might actually be a very dangerous place. And that also kind of this domestic bliss is not really what it might look on the outside. And I think that's kind of a very feminist thing to do.
Yes. It gives you a sense that you are, if your family life is not perfect, that you are not alone mm-hmm. and that there's a way out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and one thing that's definitely true for My Favorite Murder, but also the podcast that I do and many other true crime media made by women, is that they are done with a very dark sense of humor. We already talked about this a bit. And I think it's also one of the reasons why those media are very often misunderstood, because people think we joke about murder or the victims, or we make light of a very dark and terrible topic. Some people also think that we as in people who do true crime media, glorify the murder, the murderers, especially in the case of serial killers. But the truth of the matter is, I think many women, me included, are very anxious about violence and the potential violence that could be done to us. And the humor is kind of a way of dealing with that anxiety. So we're not making fun of victims, but we're trying to deal with the fact that all of us are potential victims ourselves, or at least with the fact that we all learn from a very young age that we belong to that group of people that are potential victims ourselves.
Yeah. And it also goes to the idea that we can be anxious about it and we can suffer from that anxiety, or we can find a way to move forward. And one of the best ways often to move forward is with humor. Mm-hmm. And one of the best ways to deal with anxiety or being scared is through humor. So, you know, it may be a dark sense of humor. It may seem inappropriate at times, but mm-hmm. it's a way of processing the emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also read an Atlantic article with the headline "How a True Crime Podcast Became a Mental Health Support Group," and I found this mental health support group thing so accurate. So one of the things that George and Karen talk very openly about is their own struggles with depression and anxiety, and then they also talk about how that relates to the interest in true crime, and they also talk about their experiences with therapy. But then on the other hand, I think talking about true crime itself can be very therapeutic for women. Mm-hmm. And the article says, quote, "There's a deeper connection, however, between enjoying grisly crime stories and opening up about mental health. It isn't just that the podcast mashes the two together. My Favorite Murder exposes listeners to two taboo subjects, murder, of course, and mental health. At the same time, it empowers listeners by offering practical advice for survival and self-care, and by using comedy to deflate the scariness of these topics. This approach helps listeners to get up the nerve to address their mental health needs, but also simply talking about murder in this context may soothe listeners' fear of being killed." In the article, Georgia Hardstark, one of the hosts, is also quoted saying that for her, true crime is kind of exposure therapy, which is, as I said, something that I can relate to a lot. Yeah. And then Amanda Vickery, one of the authors of the study that I told you about, she's a social psychologist, and she said that there might be an evolutionary reason for women's obsession with the genre. She says, "We've adapted to pay attention to anything that can help us increase our survival. So it could be the fact that we're just in tune and interested in these things that are dangerous to us, because understanding and knowing about them can increase our chances that it's not going to happen to us."
I read another study that talked about that we, as women particularly, develop our empathy through mm-hmm. reading these stories. And so we have a greater sense of empathizing.
Oh, that's also a great point. That is a mm-hmm. great point, too. It's not just about fear, but also about empathy. Yeah.
Yeah. Empathizing with the people who were murdered, who were victimized, who were, you know, the violence was committed mm-hmm. against them, that you have, a greater sense of relating to those people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One thing that I would also like to talk about is one risk that might have, because I think it's sometimes called the gender fear paradox, which is that men are statistically more likely to be victims of crime, but women are much more afraid of crime.
Because we are not, I mean, the question is, like, are we we afraid of it, and therefore we are more careful, so therefore crime isn't committed against us as much because we have implemented all of these things to be careful and protect ourselves against crime? Or are we afraid because we keep reading these stories? Like,
yeah. And then also one thing that I would also like to add to this is we might not be victims of crime in to the extent that men are, but the types of crimes that are victims, that we tend to be victims of disproportionately, are also exactly the types of crimes that we seem to be interested in. So anxiety about these types of crimes seems to be not as, you know, ludicrous. But of course, there is this risk, and that's also something that Vickery, the author of the study, worries about, is that indulging in this true crime obsession can kind of create a feedback loop of terror, you know, because you just hear, you're anxious, and then you hear more about crime, and you hear more about serial killers, and more about people being killed, and it's going to increase your anxiety, and it's kind of turning into this vicious cycle.
When you think about, in 2006, there were 108,000 rapes committed in the United States. That was 2015. 109,000 rapes. In 2016, there were 112,000 rapes.
That's just the ones that get reported.
And the majority of those are probably committed against women. So, you know, it's a concern.
Yeah, it is a concern. And it's understandable that we want to know about those things and just learn about those things, you know.
Yeah.
But that there's also more critique when it comes to the true crime genre. And one of those is particularly against, like, My Favorite Murder, that this kind of fuck politeness thing might also kind of imply potential victim blaming, because it kind of creates this illusion that we can control whether we are victimized or not. And it also creates unnecessary anxiety. So there is this, and I found a Medium article, which is also called, I think, Why Women Are Obsessed with True Crime. And the author also says that My Favorite Murder's implicit thesis is that by being smart and fierce, women can protect ourselves from random attacks from rapists and murderers.
I mean, the problem is a random attack is a random attack. You know, there's hardly, you can do everything right. You can do everything textbook right and still be attacked.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think this is something that I can see would be problematic with fuck politeness, you know. Although I think that's just one aspect of it. And I think there are lots of other aspects to it that are very feminist and empowering. You know, I think it's very empowering to say you don't need to be agreeable all the time, and you're allowed to protect yourself if something doesn't feel right, and you're allowed to do only what feels safe for you. I think it's a problem to believe that just because you are not polite, you are smart enough to... I think the problem is if people think that you only get killed and raped when you're stupid. You know what I mean? Like, too stupid to...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like I said, you can do everything totally right, and you can fuck politeness, and you can be a badass bitch.
And it still happens.
That could be the thing that sets someone off.
Because the problem is not with you. The problem is not with the victim.
The problem is not with you. Yes. I mean, it's the thing, and I think that we're going to talk about this a little bit, but it's like the thing with the Golden State Killer.
In the case of the Golden State Killer, and we can talk about this a little bit, I think, you know, he was engaged to a woman called Bonnie, and this is quote-unquote related to the crimes, because in his rape and murder spree, I don't think we can call it a spree, but series, he often, as part of his crimes, then said things like, I hate you, Bonnie, or I'm sorry, Bonnie. So he kind of addressed... this woman, or he addressed his female victims as this woman that he was engaged to. And
And then the media just focused on how, like, oh, well, he had been engaged to, like, once we knew who he was, then, because they thought that he might be saying mommy, but now we found out who he was, and we found out that he was engaged to this woman named Bonnie, and suddenly Bonnie's to blame for setting him off so that he would kill these women. She's not to blame. He's the murderer.
Yeah. Period. And then there are...
alleged murderer.
It's horrible, because then there were headlines like, breakup with Bonnie may have fueled Golden State Killer. And then they also tried to kind of reveal the identity of Bonnie with the Daily Mail.
Which is just so fucking rude.
And it's so wrong, because she might be a victim. I mean, in a sense, she's a victim too now, you know?
Yes.
And she, as far as we know, she was not involved in those crimes. She had nothing to do with it, as far as we know. So leave her alone. And also, again, it's this thing of blaming a woman for a man's choices, you know?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Screw all of that. The media can, it makes me so angry when we start to see, I think there was a mass shooter who they started to blame, you know, the girl who broke up with him. And one of my friends took that headline that said like, that, you know, girlfriend breakup with girlfriend spurns, you know, mass shooter to kill people at this high school, which again, this only happens in America. But she like crossed it out and said like toxic masculinity leads shooter to shoot, you know, classmates at high school, and was like, there, I fixed it for you.
Yeah.
Because that's bullshit. She didn't do anything. She, it's perfectly fine for her to say, I don't want to date you.
Yeah. But I think it's just so telling that even in the year of Me Too and all of that, you know, America's most notorious serial killer gets caught and the media does the exact same thing that it does every time, which is blame a woman for it, because what else are you going to do?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And then I think, you know, one thing that I also wanted to talk about is, or basically the last thing that I wanted to talk about is another true crime podcast that I really love, which is Real Crime Profile. And it's done by three hosts, and two of them are actual former investigators and profilers, Jim Clementi and Laura Richards. And I love Laura Richards. So she was a profiler and an investigator for New Scotland Yard. So she also has the most perfect British accent, which is wonderful to listen to. It's just so great to listen to. And she's really an absolute heroine of mine. So she is the expert in the field of stalking, domestic violence, and coercive control. She is like an advocate, and she's not just a podcaster, but also an advocate when it comes to that. And she also co-created a risk assessment tool, which is, I think, called DASC risk assessment, for investigators and people in law enforcement to kind of assess the risk for women of being victims of male violence. And she's also the founder of a stalking advocacy service in the UK and all of that. So she's really an amazing woman. And of course, that makes the podcast very, very interesting to listen to, because they talk about very big cases such as the O.J. Simpson case or the Stephen Avery case of Making a Murderer, or also the Oscar Pistorius case or Amanda Knox, what have you. And she always brings her feminist perspective to the table and also her expertise on a subject, because she worked with victims of stalking and coercive control. And she very expertly links instances of male violence to kind of broader structural problems and talks about toxic masculinity and male entitlement and what it can lead to. And also in the context of those very well-known cases, which is a perspective that is usually not part of how the mainstream media talks about these things. And what they also do is that they always say the names of the victims and sometimes leave out the names of the perpetrators, and definitely don't mention their monikers that they sometimes use for themselves in the case of serial killers, which are also like, So I think in mainstream media, we often have this case of glorifying male perpetrators, completely forgetting the victims, victim blaming them, or even blaming women for what, you know, men are doing out of male entitlement or toxic masculinity. And I think she really, really brings such a great expert opinion to the table that is also a feminist expert opinion. So I can really, really highly recommend Real Crime Profile because of her, and also her Twitter feed, because also in the case of the Golden State Killer, she kept tweeting about it, and she also made very interesting points concerning that case. And another podcast that I really like is Red Handed, which is also a British podcast, which is done very similarly to My Favorite Murder. Those are kind of the three feminist podcasts that I like, with My Favorite Murder being the kind of funny one and Real Crime Profile being the one where I learn a lot from, especially when it comes to coercive control and all of that. So, yeah.
Nice. Well, I want to get back to the question of whether this is just a white feminist issue.
Yeah.
And I want to put it out on the table for us to think about and to talk about, and or at least just to consider. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love My Favorite Murder, and I totally appreciate the community that's developed. I think one of the best things that the community that has developed has done is when local murderinos get together, they often collect money to put toward End the Backlog, to process rape kits, which I think is, you know, if Bill Gates and any other billionaires out there want to really have a significant impact on women's lives in the United States, they could donate a shit ton of money
to End,
to
the, backlog.
End the Backlog.
Yeah.
And do process want to, all of those rape kits.
Do you want to explain for a second what End the Backlog is? Because I think American listeners might be familiar with it, but nobody else is.
In the United States, rape kits do not get processed unless charges are brought against the rapist. And they have this massive backlog of rape kits. So when someone gets raped and they go to the hospital, they take evidence, anything from underneath their fingernails, if there was semen, hairs, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And they store them to be used later, to be possibly investigated later. In some places, once the statute of limitations has run out, they've just destroyed the rape kits, which is a fucking disaster.
Jesus. Yeah. And also, it's I just wanted to say that it's not just about the rapes that are committed, that like the where they get the rape kits from that are not tested, which is also horrible, but it's also because many, many of those people were probably serial perpetrators. And you could prevent a lot of crimes from happening if they got tested.
Yes. So one of the things that they, when they have been able to test this backlog of rape kits, has been to see that there are serial rapists, and they've been able to actually clear a lot of rape cases by saying this person's already in prison. So that's really great. But they have this backlog of rape kits in the United States, and it's expensive. There's lack of policies and protocols for rape kit testing. There's gaps in knowledge. They don't know who the perpetrator is. They lack resources. They don't have clear policies, etc. Mm-hmm. So, End the Backlog, it's an organization that was, I don't recall who started it, but one of the women in the United States who really has been a massive advocate for it is Mariska Hargitay, who plays one of the lead detectives on Law & Order SVU, which is a special victims unit, which specifically looks at violent sexual crimes. And so if we could just donate money, it's endthebacklog.org. Donate money to help end the backlog of rape kits. It would be amazing. It would be fucking amazing. And any billionaire men out there who randomly happened upon our podcast and want to know what you can do help rape victims in the United States, Elon Musk, anyone, women, rape victims, donate money to End the Backlog. But anyway, I digress. So I think that's one of the things that murderinos have been, you know, doing this. They've found communities. I have loved true crime shows since I was a kid. We have so many freaking television channels in the United States dedicated to true crime. But I kind of wonder if some of the true crime genre isn't just a straight cis white woman's genre.
Mm-hmm.
And in part because we have these Lifetime movies that typically focus on a white woman, often a mother, overcoming some sort of domestic violence situation or a stalker or somebody in her family getting murdered and coming out the other end wiser and victorious.
Yep.
Dr. Howard Foreman, a forensic psychologist at Montefiore Medical Center, argues that young women's interest in true crime stems from their empathy. And he says that, quote, by the time you get to adulthood, women are able to empathize to a greater degree than men on average. This isn't to say that men don't have empathy.
Yeah.
Men have empathy too.
And it's not to say that it's a result of biology also.
No, not at all. It's socialization.
Yeah.
But that may lead to true crime being more interesting to women than men, simply because if you empathize more with the victim, it may be more relevant to you and more gripping.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if empathy explains it completely though. Foreman suspects that there's actually something unique about the genre of true crime itself that speaks to women in ways that it doesn't for men. And he points to a handful of factors.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, society has been exposed to death only through men dying in like war or other, other types of violence. So we have kind of a numbness toward men dying. and we may be more sensitive to women dying, something that true crime stories aren't afraid to show, and that plays into this larger sense of empathy. Women haven't been given the same latitude socially to be aggressive like men have, and we talked about this earlier.
Yeah.
And then on-screen victims let female viewers temporarily live through the victim they're watching. And so this is kind of a sublimation process wherein they take on the role of this victim. Mm-hmm. And as we said, possibly learning from her mistakes, and let's not call them mistakes, learning from the situation as to how one could possibly act in that situation that would be different. But I think it's this last point, which might be interesting in true crime, and where true crime often becomes a straight, cis, white, upper middle class women's thing.
Mm-hmm.
We have become more aware of the fact that the trans population is particularly vulnerable to violence.
Mm-hmm.
We need to recognize that historically murders within the LGBTQI community have been underreported and underinvestigated.
Yes.
We also know that the blame for the murders of sex workers has been placed on the type of work that they do rather than the people who perpetrate violence against them.
Mm-hmm.
And in each of these cases, we have tended to blame the victims, or as a society, we've chosen to ignore these deaths because as cisgendered white women, it doesn't play into our ability to empathize with the victims. We are not sex workers. We are not LGBTQI. We are not trans. So can we adequately empathize? And a lot of true crime doesn't necessarily focus on these communities either, these true crime stories that we see on television. It doesn't, we have, I don't know if this is a phrase that my husband and I have just been using for a long time, but it doesn't sell tampons. Like, it's hard to get women to, white, upper middle class women, to watch a show that doesn't have a main character that they can fully identify with.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't totally universally true, and I don't want to speak for everyone,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know if I've ever seen a Lifetime movie featuring the countless missing women and girls from the Perth People's communities.
Yeah.
So according to statistics gathered by MG Amot, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, but that's just, you know, I can't pronounce people's names.
Mm.
But he's from the Radford University, Florida Gulf Coast University serial killer database.
Mm-hmm.
While we typically associate serial killers with white men, statistics on U.S. serial killers by race indicate that on average, 40% of serial killers are black. And in 2010, it was 59%.
Mm-hmm.
4% of the world's serial killers can be found in the United States. 25% of U.S. serial killer victims are black, 7% are Hispanic, 1.8% are Asian, and 0.52% are Native. But this is from the serial killers we know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is only from serial killers. This isn't violence, and this isn't just plain murder victims. According to 2016 FBI statistics, 52% of murder victims in the U.S. are black.
Mm-hmm.
7% are black women, 44% are black men, and more black men were victims of murder in the United States in 2016 than all white victims combined. Yeah. And I don't care if someone is murdered in a shooting in their neighborhood. If it's a random shooting, I don't care what the circumstances are. The fact that the only shows that we see on TV are primarily of white women overcoming any sort of murderer or featuring white women being murdered doesn't jibe with the statistics that we have that 52% of murder victims in the United States are black.
Mm.
So let me give a further example. While we've been so focused on the Golden State Killer, in part because of Michelle McNamara's book, but also because he was recently caught, I haven't seen nearly the focus on the Grim Creeper, who was arrested in 2010. Who is the Grim Creeper or Grim Sleeper?
Oh, okay. Grim Sleeper. I know that.
Grim Sleeper.
Yeah, I know the Grim Sleeper. Grim Creeper, Grim Sleeper. I've never heard that. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, no. It's Grim Sleeper.
Okay.
He terrorized South Central Los Angeles for almost 2 decades.
Hmm.
The murderer targeted the community's most vulnerable women, impoverished black sex workers who he presumed that no one would miss. So he picked victims that he thought nobody was going to report were missing.
Mm-hmm.
From 1985 to 2006, these murders were largely ignored by the Los Angeles Police Department until a female crime reporter took an interest in the unsolved crimes. In 2006, she started covering the city's disregard for these victims in LA Weekly, a local newspaper, And she exposed how the crimes were brushed under the rug, how community organizations were not notified about the serial killer operating in their area, and how many of the victims' families were kept in the dark. And let's compare this to the Golden State Killer. There was so much media attention, even in the 70s and 80s, about the Golden State Killer. Now, it was dispersed in a lot of different areas. This was centralized. This was a community that the Los Angeles Police Department did not even notify that they had a serial killer. So while we know a handful of his victims, he kept photos and videos of women who we have yet to identify. Investigators found over 1,000 photos and several hundred hours of video in his home. The images show mainly Black women of a wide age range, from teenagers to middle age to older, often nude. The photos, a lot of the photos were released to the public in an effort to identify the women, but only about 14 of these women, 12 of these women are known. And I don't want to get into a pissing contest about the number of murders committed, because every murder victim is important. And I get that the Grim Sleeper was arrested in 2010, so it's an older story.
Yeah.
But the media furor over a guy who terrorized upper-middle-class white folks, in comparison to a relative lack of focus on a man who could have murdered potentially hundreds of impoverished Black sex workers, or maybe not even sex workers, just Black women, shows some potential bias in the true crime community.
Yes, obviously, obviously.
But it also shows the potential for a broader understanding for this huge community of mostly women. If we can use the power of our community to draw attention to the violence and murder in communities outside of our own, that so that true crime isn't just a way to send to address our potential fears of violence, but a way to counter the patriarchy in a really intersectional way, I think that could be the true power of the true crime community of women that has really been established. To say, yeah, we like listening to these true crime stories and it empowers us, but let's use this to empower other people. And that's why I think that the and the backlog stuff is really important. And I think that middle class, cisgendered, straight white women can and even just white women generally can start to raise the profile of persons of color who have been murdered and victimized. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's not necessarily our story to tell, but it's our responsibility to make more people aware of it.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I completely get your criticism and I agree. I absolutely agree. But I think there are two sides to it. I think on the one hand, we have traditional true crime, which is really like focused on white cisgender women victims. But I just think there is a new wave of true crime media that are aware of the problem. And I'm not saying that they perfectly handle the problem or they are always perfectly intersectional. But I think there is more awareness of the problem than it was before. And I think we're kind of improving and evolving, you know, I think. So I think there's two sides to that.
I agree with you. I would like to see mainstream true crime focus more on people of color. Because if more than 50% of the victims of murder in this country are people of color, then why doesn't our media show that?
Yeah. So one of the most haunting disappearances that I ever heard about, and when it comes to the true crime genre, disappearances are what scares me the most, because I think there's nothing more scary than a person just vanishing. I think it's just so, I mean, it just scares me so much. And one of the most scary things I've ever heard about was the disappearance of Asia Decree. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but it always puzzled my mind that, and it's a case that is talked a lot about on true crime podcasts, but it's not talked about at all in mainstream media in any way. And I don't consider most true crime podcasts to be mainstream media. I mean, with mainstream media, I mean like newspaper or TV shows or something like that. Everybody knows about John Benny Ramsey and Madeleine Kane and all of those people, Madeleine McCain. But Asia Decree was a Black girl and she just disappeared and nobody cares about it in the mainstream media. So I think, So I think what I wanted to say with that is it kind of proves your point that the mainstream media doesn't really care about people that, people of color or trans people being victimized. But I think there are sections of the true crime community that do care.
No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, we talked about the DC area in it, there are in Washington, D.C., they had 501 cases of missing children. By March 2017, they had had 105 cases of missing children. And 22 of those cases were still open.
God.
By March.
Okay.
So this is an epidemic. This is a massive problem that we don't seem to be concerned about it, but we can do something about it. We can raise the profile. We can keep posting in social media. I mean, I'm sometimes a little critical about social media activism, but the more visibility something gets, the better in terms of these types of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a feminist issue.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely, I mean, missing women, missing girls, missing sex workers, missing people, missing marginalized people.
Is a feminist issue. All right.
Oh, and on a totally separate note, I just want to let you know, my husband just sent me a text. Since we're talking about true crime today, police in Germany have arrested a man who may have murdered 21 of his coworkers.
Oh, yes.
By poisoning their lunches in a killing spree stretching back to 2000.
But you know what he did? He, it's so weird. It's like one of the weirdest things I've ever heard, because he poisoned them with lead, which is something.
He sprinkled their food with it.
But the thing is, you don't immediately die. It's just something that you get sick from. And there were so many cases of people getting cancer and like heart attacks and just getting sick in this company, which was really strange, but they didn't know what was going on. And apparently he just killed them very, very, very slowly. He was a very patient serial killer, apparently.
Yes. So I guess lesson learned. I need a food taster.
Or don't put food anywhere where other people can have access to it. Go to bed with your refrigerator.
Yes. Yes. Don't give other people access to your food.
Never.
Donate money to end the backlog. And
fuck politeness.
Fuck politeness and post the hell out of anything that you see about people of color being victimized or murdered, because the profile on those is just as important as when white women disappear too.
Yes. And stay nasty.
Stay nasty.
Bye.
Bye.
Der Geschwistergrün-Podcast.
Land der Berge.
Land am Strome.
Land von Jack Unterweger und Elfriede Blaunsteiner.
Das reimt sich jetzt nicht ganz, aber wir werden uns nicht mit den großen Töchtern und Söhnen dieses Landes beschäftigen, sondern mit den grauslichsten Grauslichkeiten.
Aus der Insel der Seligen von